Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Mark Dunlay.
And I'm Andrea Cunliffe. Today, we continue our election candidate coverage with an interview with Robert Porter, the Libertarian and Republican candidate for State Assembly in the 109th Assembly District.
Then, on this week's Peace Bucket, Honduras has become the 50th nation to ratify the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. We discuss this development with Alice Slater of World Beyond War.
And later on, we talk with Assembly Member Pat Fahey about her reelection effort in Albany.
Then we have the second episode of Birth Justice. In it, Catherine Rafferty interviews Bridget Roddy Garrison, a certified nurse midwife from Rochester.
We end with a conversation with Liz Joy, the Republican congressional candidate who is challenging New York State's Congress member Paul Tonko. But first, the headlines.
Keith Raniere, the leader of the NXIVM sex cult and self-empowerment group based in Clifton Park, was sentenced on Tuesday to 120 years in prison. Raniere was convicted of sex trafficking, forced labor conspiracy, and racketeering charges.
As communities across New York continue to see long lines at the polls for early voting, some local election officials are expanding hours to meet the demand. Local board of elections are supposed to keep wait times under 30 minutes. The Rensselaer County Board of Elections has been criticized for repeatedly refusing to provide an early voting site in the city of Troy. In the Capital District, only Schenectady County so far has extended voting hours for the weekend.
Get out your snow shovels. The National Weather Service says a storm bringing winter weather to Texas will continue with cold Canadian air and remnants of Hurricane Zeta to bring about an inch of snow to upstate New York by Friday morning. Areas in higher elevations, like Post and Kill, where I'm broadcasting from, may see 4 inches of snow.
Oh, dear. A judge has granted the New York State Civil Liberties Union request to join the lawsuit over the release of disciplinary files for the city of Schenectady police officer involved in a controversial arrest this summer. According to the Daily Gazette, the NYCLU has argued that they are better positioned than city agencies, including the city police department, to advocate the public's interest when it comes to whether unsubstantiated claims of misconduct against the police officer should be released.
The Times Union reports that a second wave of coronavirus infections, hospitalizations, and deaths is well on its way in the Capital Region. New daily cases across 8 local counties have increased noticeably, coming just 17 cases shy recently of the region's spring peak of 147 new cases recorded May 1st.
A fourth resident in the Ghent assisted living facility in Columbia County has died of COVID-19. As of Monday, 17 of the county's 19 coronavirus hospitalizations stemmed from the home. The most recent victim marks the 41st death in the county due to the virus. So for those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
This program is made possible by local volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If keeping local independent news free to the public is important to you, find out how you can give by going to mediasanctuary.org or call 518-272-2390. Otherwise, email us at info@mediasanctuary.org.
And for our first segment tonight, Robert Porter is the Libertarian candidate for State Assembly in the 109th Assembly District for Albany. As we discussed taxes, COVID, and other issues, Mark Dunley is reporting for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're talking with Robert Porter, likes to be called Barr, who is the Libertarian candidate in the 109th Assembly District. He also has the endorsement of the Republicans and I believe the Conservative. 109th Assembly District, I believe, is mainly Albany County. But, you know, Barr, why don't you just give us a quick introduction, who you are and why you decided to run?
Thank you, Mark. I served in the Marine Corps for 21 years, and I came home and I saw a candidate on the ballot who had every single party, and I've also seen other candidates run unopposed. And I felt that the people should have a choice when they go into the ballots to decide who they want to represent them in a public office.
So what are some of the key issues that you, you know, would like to enact if elected?
Well, I'm not one for just enacting laws because I'm elected and I'm in office. I think that we have a lot of laws that are on the books that are confusing, that contradict each other, and we need to make things simpler so people understand it. So I would actually try and do less laws and cut the budget, cut the deficit, cut taxes.
Yeah, so I know taxes, just reading some of your previous interviews, you know, is a key concern. Yet, I'm not sure the exact figure, but New York State claims is facing a $30 billion deficit now because of the, well, at least partially due to the COVID-19 crisis. How do you sort of balance that, you know, loss of state revenue with, you know, your desire to, you know, I guess lower taxes?
Well, I mean, just yesterday I was driving by the state offices off of Washington Avenue, and there's a fleet of cars being sold by the government because they're no longer useful. They don't run or whatever. And that's a huge expense just sitting there that is being wasted. That's not to mention all the maintenance that goes into all those vehicles, not all the fuel that goes into all those vehicles. There's got to be a better way for the government to spend our money and save our money.
Now, I understand the first time you ran, this is, I believe your second time in this office, you ran as a Republican, but recently you decided to change your registration to a Libertarian. What attracts you to the Libertarian Party?
Well, it actually came down to the fact that it's voter discrimination. It's ballot access. When the Libertarians weren't a line on the ballot, the state required me to get three times as many signatures to run as a Libertarian as any party on the line. So and you had to do this after all the line parties got their signatures. So it was almost impossible to get on the ballot if you weren't a line already on the ballot. So I've always been a Libertarian. I picked Republican because everybody else was a Democrat and I wanted people to have a choice.
You know, you were in the Marines for quite a few years, a part of their, working in law enforcement. You know, what do you feel about, you know, some of the changes that have been enacted in New York recently, say on bail reform?
Well, I've looked at bail reform, and unfortunately to me, it looks like it's put a revolving door on our criminal justice system. A person is arrested for committing a crime, they're suspected of committing a crime, and they're immediately released without having to post bail, and they're out. In many cases, they commit another crime almost immediately. I agree that there's a problem with bail, but releasing a person immediately isn't the solution. And so I would look into a different way of helping law enforcement enforce the laws and holding people accountable for the things that they do.
COVID-19 has certainly impacted a lot of people, particularly in New York. You know, what do you think is, you know, the quality of the response has been from Cuomo and the New York State government? And how would you think that, you know, we should move forward with, you know, COVID in the coming months?
Well, when I was in the Marines, I got taught how to survive in a biological environment. And that was wearing a mop suit and a chemical mask. People have seen pictures of it. We've seen pictures of police having to go in where somebody is suspected of mailing in anthrax, and the protective gear that they wear, the hazmat suits that they wear. And at no time do you ever see anybody wearing a face covering to protect them in these environments. This COVID situation has been blown out of proportion. It's nothing close to what it's being touted as. It's not another Spanish flu from 1918. I know three people who've been exposed to it, tested positive, and all three were in high risk categories, and all three survived and didn't have to go to the hospital. So it's not what it's being made out to be. And I think that we should get back to work and reopen New York so people can start making a living and get ourselves out of this deficit.
How, serious do you think the, COVID-19 is? Is it just a little stronger version of the flu, or are there other health concerns related to COVID?
My understanding, COVID is closer to the common cold than the flu. And that has been a concern with some of the early testing. They couldn't differentiate between the two. And so there may have been some false tests, positives for COVID. But like I said, we need to look at the totalitarian side of this and say, is the government overstepping and forcing all these restrictions when it's not as bad as it's being made out to be?
Now, most people run for office always, say two things. We're going to cut taxes and we're going to create jobs. So do you have any ideas about how New York could better help with employment, particularly in the Capital District?
Well, one thing is employment. The government can't create jobs out of the blue. People need to want to work in New York State. And with the high taxes that we have here, we don't attract people to open businesses in New York. It's just too expensive. We lost the Amazon deal. It would have been millions of dollars worth of revenue and hundreds of jobs, because we just can't compete. We need to lower the taxes, make it a place where people want to work. We're losing people to other states because they don't want to live here because it's too expensive to live here. So we lose a population, and when we don't have jobs, we need to change that.
So I ran into Larry Sharp a few times. He was a Libertarian candidate for governor back in 2018. And I noticed a lot of his supporters had two key issues they were focused upon. One was legalization of marijuana, and the second one was gun rights. How do you stand on those two issues?
Well, I actually got sent to the U.S.-Mexican border as a Marine to stop drugs from coming across the border. And, the drugs are still here. We wasted time. We wasted money trying to stop these drugs from coming across the border. Colorado had a $14 million windfall when they legalized recreational marijuana. It would save, it would make, money for New York State if we changed that policy. Gun rights. I don't own any firearms. I had all the firearms I needed supplied to me by the Marine Corps, but if a person wants to own a gun, they should be able to. And if a criminal has a gun, they should be prosecuted and held accountable for having that firearm. We shouldn't make law-abiding citizens criminals for owning a gun.
So we've been talking with Robert Porter, the Libertarian, Republican, and conservative candidate in the 109th Assembly District. Barr, if people want more information about you, how can they find it out?
Well, I have a Twitter account. It's 4_Porter. And I have a Facebook page, and it's Porter Robert 109.
Well, thank you very much, Barr. This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio. And this is part of our ongoing coverage of the election. Voting is already underway here in New York State. And next Tuesday, of course, will be Election Day. A little bit later in the show, we'll have an interview with Pat Fahey, who is Mr. Porter's opposition in the November election.
Honduras recently became the 50th nation to formally ratify the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, meaning it will become international law in 3 months. The U.S. and the other 8 nations with nuclear weapons, however, have not ratified it. We discussed the importance of the treaty with Alice Slater of World Beyond War with Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're talking with Alice Slater, who is with World Beyond War. And there was some exciting news recently when Honduras became the 50th country to ratify the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. So, Alice, why don't you give us a quick introduction to what is World Beyond War and why is Honduras signing on important?
Well, World Beyond War is a wonderful new organization that's working to make the end of war on the planet an idea whose time has come, because we're in silos, like, and I'm dealing a lot with nuclear weapons, and that's why this new treaty is fabulous, because this is a treaty that bans the bomb and says they're illegal, you can't have them, you can't use them, you can't threaten to use them. We never had that. We did it for biological and chemical weapons and landmines and cluster bombs, but we never did it for nuclear weapons. And this was like a 10-year campaign, and we got the UN to vote, 122 nations to pass the treaty. We won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017. And now we have about over 80 countries have signed the treaty, but in order for it to go into effect, which is the legal term, to take effect, you need 50. Well, we hit 50 this week on the 75th anniversary of the founding of the United Nations, and this was like so splendid.
Now, what exactly does the treaty do?
Well, the treaty fills a legal gap because for years, since 1970, we've had the Non-Proliferation Treaty that said that the U.S., Russia, England, France, and China would make good faith efforts to give up their nuclear weapons, and all the rest of the world promised not to get them. And only 3 countries didn't sign, India, Pakistan, Israel, they got them, and North Korea walked out of the treaty and got them. But it never said they're prohibited or you can't have them. And we have a NATO alliance, which is now pushing up to Russia's borders, where we keep nuclear weapons in 5 NATO states, like Germany, Belgium, Holland, Turkey, and France. And there's huge grassroots activity now to get the U.S. nuclear weapons out of their country now that they're illegal. The world said they're illegal.
Now, I understand, unfortunately, that the United States and the world's other 8 other nuclear armed countries, Russia, China, Britain, France, India, Pakistan, North Korea, and Israel, they boycotted the negotiations, have not signed the treaty. So therefore, they're not actually covered by it.
No, this is very, not only did they not sign it, they boycotted it. And this last year, the U.S. was lobbying governments to unsign the treaty because they were so afraid that we get that 50th country and then we could say this is international law. But we never signed the landmines treaty in the United States, but we don't make them, we don't use them. This will stigmatize nuclear weapons. They've never been declared unlawful to threaten to use them or have them or possess them or share them. We've been doing that with all these other countries for years. So it's a big change in how we look at nuclear weapons. Like even the Pope was helping us in this campaign. Like the church used to say, it's okay to have nuclear weapons if you need them for, you know, if your survival is at stake, deterrence policy. And this new Pope said, you should never have them. They're always illegal. And that's what the treaty does. And it's changing the whole conversation, global conversation about nuclear weapons. And it's bound to come back in the U.S., in other countries that hold them, that will feel like it just doesn't seem right to keep having and making and sharing nuclear weapons.
Well, I mean, speaking of the Pope, he seems to be increasingly to the left of the Democratic Party, let alone the Republican Party.
And of his own party.
but there is an election taking place right now. You know, what has, you know, Mr. Biden and the Democrats said about the issue, both of this treaty in particular and, you know, nuclear disarmament in general?
There's no difference. As a matter of fact, as much as we must get rid of Trump because he's, you know, planning to be the next Hitler, Trump, they say even a broken clock is twice right twice a day. He came in and said, I'm going to make a deal with North Korea. I'm going to make a deal with Russia. And the Democrats wouldn't let him. He actually negotiated with North Korea that we would take 10,000 troops out of that country on the border that have been there since 1953. And we're sanctioning them. And sanctions sound so nice. It's a siege. We've been starving them since 1953. And the Democrats voted against taking troops out.
Well, so I always tell people first time I ran for office was I ran for Congress in 1982 as a Citizens Party candidate. And the incumbent was Sam Stratton. And Sam was known for only three things. And one of them was for keeping the troops in South Korea. In fact, when Carter tried to get him out, Sam, who was on the House Foreign Service Committee or Military Committee, actually flew over to Seoul just to hold a press conference to, you know, make sure that we would not take the troops out. But putting aside Korea, where do the Democrats stand on nuclear weapons?
They're terrible. Obama made this little deal with Medvedev, who was the prime minister of Russia for a little while. Putin, you know, stepped aside for him to, he made a deal to cut like 1,500 nuclear bombs out of our arsenals of 8,000. And right now there are 14,000 nuclear weapons on the planet and 13,000 are in the US and Russia. It's up to us. So he made this deal. And in order to get it through Congress, he promised $1 trillion over the next 20 years for two new bomb factories at Los Alamos and in Kansas City, Kansas, new missiles, planes, submarines, and Trump just passed it and upped the ante. There's no difference between Democrats and Republicans when it comes to the greed and corruption of the military, industrial, academic, congressional, media complex. We're totally blocked. And what we have to do, as far as I'm concerned, is get rid of Trump and then get on top of Biden's neck and make sure he does the right thing, because he's not for Medicare for All. He's not for nuclear disarmament. He's for upping the war machine against China and Russia even more than Trump was. So
other than fighting Biden starting on November 4th.
Right.
Well, what are we going to do in terms of when this, I guess it's now international law, how are people going to proceed, you know, now that this 50 states, countries signed it to implement it? And we have 2 minutes left.
Okay. We had this great initial talk on Zoom, like about 100 people from all over the world this weekend when it happened, where the treaty actually takes effect 90 days after the 50th. So that'll be January 22nd, 21. And we were talking about lighting up the Eiffel Tower and the Empire State Building and going all these. We have so many people in this network that got it through the UN that are all going to work in their countries to have some incredible celebration on that day. Then there are people already picketing in Germany. There are resolutions in the Italian and Belgium and Dutch parliament to get out of the U.S. nuclear alliance in NATO and give up their nuclear bases. So there's going to be a lot of grassroots pressure, not in our country initially, but we'll hear about it. And hopefully it'll get stigmatized and people say, you know, this will be the opening crack for getting rid of the bomb.
And that will be right around Inauguration Day.
Yay.
So maybe we can bring some nuclear missile props to the down to D.C.
That's a good idea. I'm going to put it out to our network and tell them you said so, Mark.
Okay. So we've been talking with Alice Slater from World Beyond War. Alice, if people, you know, want to check out both this treaty and also World Beyond War, is there a good website?
Well, for the treaty, ICANW.org, ICANW.org, International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, and worldbeyondwar.org. Please go there, sign up, take a pledge that you want to be responsible for getting rid of war on the planet. And that's what we're doing right now.
Well, thank you very much, Alice Slater. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. And that was Alice. Part of our every Wednesday, we try to have a peace bucket, and Alice, a longtime peace activist, said she'll help us find guests in the future.
And for those of you just tuning in, I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy. And WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, coming to you from the Sanctuary of Independent Media in Troy. This program is made possible by local volunteers and Sanctuary Sustainer monthly donors. We have just 3 days left to reach our goal of 50 new sustainers by the end of October. If you are able to give support, you can hit the donate button at mediasanctuary.org or email us at info@mediasanctuary.org or call 518-272-2390. We now continue with Assemblymember Pat Fahey. We heard earlier from her opponent, Mr. Porter. She is seeking her fifth term in the 109th Assembly District, and that includes most of the city of Albany and the towns of New Scotland, Bethlehem, and Gilderland. We're talking with Assemblymember Pat Fahey, who represents the 109th Assembly District, which includes a good part of the city of Albany and then several of the towns in Albany County, New Scotland, Gilderland, and I believe Bethlehem. Assemblymember, you know, Fahey, you know, maybe just give a quick introduction as to, you know, who you are and, you know, why you're running for re-election.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me. Again, I'm Pat Fahey. I represent the towns and the city of Albany that you mentioned. I am running for my fifth term. Those are two-year terms, so I'm just finishing 8 years. And running harder than ever because I think the challenges are more overwhelming than ever, especially with the health challenges that we've seen through COVID and then the complete economic upheaval that has resulted in the state and region, let alone in the entire country and world, as a result of COVID. So the economic challenges, which for me mean jobs and especially small businesses, I think make our work all the more important. And and all of that, I think, fuels the growing economic inequality. And as well as with the way education has played out, with so many children having to learn virtually, I think we're about to fuel the academic gap too. So there's challenges throughout, and then of course there's climate change, which is overarching all of this. So I'm as motivated as ever. There you go.
So you mentioned at the top the issue of COVID. How do you think New York State has done in dealing with the COVID situation, and what should we be doing, you know, moving forward? You know, I guess both to deal with the health impacts and also the fiscal recession impacts.
Overall, especially early on, I think New York made a number of right moves, and I give the governor a good deal of credit on that, with some what I think were critical missteps, and we've all heard of those, such as with the nursing home, the idea of not wearing masks initially. I thought masks were important from day one. So we made some critical missteps, and I think we're still paying a bit of a price for that. But now, you've probably seen I've become very, very vocal this summer, especially early this summer, about trying to reopen in a very safe manner, reopen critical parts of the economy. So, and I think we still have to be very mindful of that. When you have 90% of restaurants in New York City not able to make their August or September rent. We have and the ripple effects of what those small and often wholly owned restaurants, the ripple effect of that with jobs as well as into the rest of the economy. We have some very serious and dire economic challenges ahead of us.
One of the economic challenges, of course, has been the big decline in state revenues, and already a number of the schools have cut back on both staff and gone to virtual classes, particularly for the older students. How should the state, try to deal with its, revenue shortfall, and how, this idea of, tax the rich, how should that be incorporated into that solution?
I think, first of all, we are in the biggest dire financial straits that I have seen, particularly since I've been in office. So it is serious. There's no doubt we've got to have that federal, those stimulus dollars. And I hope next Tuesday, I do hope we will see a success with Joe Biden being elected. And I hope his first order of business will be an infrastructure plan, will be which includes a stimulus plan, which includes the climate change. But I am not confident the feds will completely bail us out, if you will, especially with a $14 billion deficit just this year alone. So everything, in my view, everything's got to be put on the table, including the revenue raisers that have been so discussed, especially this year. The pied-à-terre tax, the wealthy, the ultra-millionaire tax, some of the stock transfer tax. We've got to look at each of those. We have to be mindful of them, right? We see that New Jersey is, we're going to learn a few lessons from New Jersey, but they all have to be put on the table. But nothing will escape some belt tightening as well. We are going to struggle. I think, I have a bill to create jobs. I think we have to really target the creative economy as well as environmental, green type jobs and put people back to work. It's not enough to just worry about making sure people are getting their unemployment checks. Young people have been hardest hit by this economic devastation, and they are the people we need to target to give jobs to. So I have a WPA, Works Progress Administration type bill modeled after the 1930s. And aside from, again, revenue raisers, we also need to do things to really get the economy going for individuals.
You mentioned climate change as a critical issue. And obviously last year, the state passed the CLCPA to set up some new goals, but yet there's also a planning process that takes 4 years, and climate change, appears to be accelerating. What role can the state legislature do in helping to move, the state along on the transition to a clean energy future?
Oh, I think there's still a number of things that we can do. And quite frankly, I'm not sure we can be aggressive enough on all the environment and energy issues. One example is plastics, the plastics pollution. If we were to require that more of our individual use plastic bottles be made from recycled materials, I have a bill that I think it's 50% going up to 75%. Any of that will help stimulate the recycled markets that have been so devastated by the China sword policy, where they quit taking a lot of our recyclable materials. So we've got to look at plastics pollution. Transportation has taken a setback because public transportation has been poo-pooed, if you will, under COVID. So we've seen less people now relying on public transportation. They're particularly seeing that in New York City. And somehow we've got to make sure that people feel safe with public transportation and not go backwards. But I'm also, on the good note, we are seeing people rediscover biking and walking, and we have to take advantage of that. I have a bill that passed a year ago to create a master trails plan for the state. We have to really make sure that we are the safest place to be under COVID, right, is outside. So we need to make sure that we are pushing that in a positive way and not going backwards on transportation emissions. Also, I have a couple of bills on electric vehicles. I'd love to see us incentivize that more. I've got a whole package, and other members have other bills, but I don't think COVID should be an excuse for us to put climate change, meaning energy and environmental issues, on the back burner. COVID should not be an excuse. And I was disappointed when we put off the Bond Act.
So we are talking with Assembly Member Pat Fahey. Have about 90 seconds left. Sort of a two-part question. Criminal justice reform, Black Lives Matter has been, a big issue, particularly in Albany and some of the suburbs. But also, City of Albany recently requested help dealing with the increased incidence of gun violence in the city. Your thoughts on how do we move forward on these issues?
These are some of the social and racial justice issues also overlap this. One of the things that I mentioned early on is making sure that we can get children and youth back into school as quickly as possible and, of course, as safe a manner as possible. Virtual learning, the studies that we do have, it is nowhere near as effective by and large for most students. I think that's hurt. I also think we need jobs. We've got to emphasize jobs regardless of how tough the economy is. And who have been the first people knocked out of the workforce under COVID this past March were millennials. That's those 35 and under, as well as individuals of color. So whether youth and youth of color were the most impacted, I think we've got to find ways to put them back to work, in especially those in the creative economy and green jobs. You can't transport, you can't send green jobs overseas. So I think that's another part. We also have to address some income inequality. And then with regard to just some of the street violence, I think we need to make sure we are continuing to have the transparency that we passed a number of bills on that in June, to make sure that we are working with our police we are minimizing any type of police violence and making sure that there is a transparency there. I'm proud that Albany was one of the first places that adopted the cameras. All the police there wear cameras.
We're out of time, unfortunately. This has been Assemblymember Pat Fahey, 109th Assembly District, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Mark Dunley was speaking with Pat Fahey, seeking her fifth term for the New York State Assembly, District 109. Now we go to HMM's Catherine Rafferty for the second installment of the Birth Justice Podcast with Bridget Rudy Garrison, a certified nurse, midwife, from Rochester, New York, to talk about her work at home birth midwife and discuss challenges in offering out-of-hospital birth care in New York.
Welcome to the Birth Justice Podcast, where we interview birth workers, birthing people, and activists around the topic of advocacy, equity, autonomy, and respect in childbearing and reproductive care. I'm Catherine Rafferty. Today, we're joined by Brigitte Rody Garrison, certified nurse midwife from Rochester, New York, to talk about her work as a home birth midwife and to discuss midwifery certification in New York. I met Brigitte last year in Rochester while I was a student at Rochester Institute of Technology. So it's great to catch up with you. How are you doing, Brigitte?
I'm doing okay, hanging in there.
Good, yeah. So why don't we start with how you got started with your work as a home birth midwife? Could you tell us a little bit more about where you work and who you work with?
Sure. So I got started because I had a really awful birth with my first baby. And so the next baby I had, I met a midwife at a party and did not know what a midwife was, did not know that they were legal in New York State or anything about them, switched my care to her, and then I had an amazing birth with her. And from then on, I have been, that has been my obsession, and I love what I do. I'm passionate about it. I went to nursing school first and then to Jefferson University, which was, at the time, it was called Philadelphia University. You need to get your master's degree. And I decided to work doing home birth because the flexibility of the schedule with my family schedule was what I needed, and not an endless hospital schedule, besides the fact that I feel like it's the most humanistic form of midwifery that we can offer, is right in the woman's own space or in the space of her choice, that's really honoring the individual rather than a group of individuals that kind of get pushed through on a conveyor belt at the hospital. Even though I trained in the hospital and I could work in the hospital, I prefer to work out of the hospital, either at home or in a birth center would be fine if there could ever be more birth centers.
So when we first met last year, we did discuss some of the barriers to enter the profession of midwifery and offer out-of-hospital care. Could you maybe talk about what some of those challenges are that you faced in your career trying to offer that type of care, especially in the area where you work in Western New York?
Sure. Yes, I feel like when I started this profession and this journey in 2009, it was not something that was well supported and interwoven into the system of the hospital. Because of course we need to refer people to higher levels of care if they need to be, like the perinatal group or a pediatrician. We need to consult. In the past, it was a mandate that we had a collaborative physician that signed our agreement. It is no longer that requirement. It is now independent. But I think that the barriers are still there in providing seamless care. But it's gotten a lot better. So I'm very hopeful about the future. And I think if there were one certification board in this state or even in this country that everyone had the same certification and passed the same test, I feel like that would be an improvement.
Could you maybe talk more about what you mean by seamless care?
Seamless care meaning if there was a woman who had a breech baby that I needed to have turned, we call that an ECV, I could arrange to have that done at a hospital. If a woman risks out of her home birth, that I could follow her into the unit and help with the delivery of the baby within a safe place. Because obviously we want low risk women, and we don't typically do higher risk births, like if somebody develops preeclampsia, if somebody's having twins or a breech baby. We need other providers to be understanding and to honor that we have credentials, but we also respect that they have more knowledge, and we need an OR sometimes. So we need to make sure everybody is on good terms and we work together.
Yeah, so you feel like that can't always be achieved every time?
I think it's gotten a lot better. I think there'd been experiences in my past where I've had terrible transfer experiences where it was traumatic not only for the mother, but it was traumatic for me as a midwife. And that was fortunately 10 years ago. But I think in the meantime, I have built a strong reputation as far as my communication and professionalism. And the hospital has also honored home birth and having Ina Mae Gaskin come in for grand rounds at right here in Rochester at Strong. And I feel like the communication it's opening up. And I've got to say, I'm hopeful about that. And I would love to be involved in figuring out a way to really bridge the gap for students who want to do out of hospital birth, because it's a whole different type of midwifery really than in the hospital.
Right. Yeah. Could you maybe just briefly talk about the difference between home birth care versus in hospital care with midwifery?
Sure. And you know, I did work at within the system at Cooperstown when I was training. I do feel like the major difference is that you really are a one-woman show in home birth. You do have an RN or a birth assistant that's helping you, but for the most part, you are it, and so you need to be very well-versed on your, nursing skills, IV skills, emergency skills, neonatal resuscitation skills, and the list goes on and on. You've kind of got to do everything. You don't have a nurse that's going to hang fluids for you or that you can order medication through. You don't have an anesthesiologist. You don't have a consulting physician right there. But all of those things can be dealt with if you have a good system and you have a seamless system that supports the choice of women to birth wherever they want to, as long as they're low risk. So that's about the biggest difference. It does feel very isolated, and you need to make sure you have good neonatal assessment skills, because when you leave, that baby is your responsibility still until that baby sees the pediatrician. So you are certified to take care of babies for 1 month as a midwife in New York State. So, you know, in the hospital, we just hand the babies over to the pediatrician. But at home, it's you. So you really, I feel like you really need more experience to do home birth or out of hospital birth than a midwife that might work in a hospital system. And I am not discounting the work that they do, because they are incredibly important as well. There's just different comfort levels with different situations. And I think it really comes with experience, and it comes with being humble to the process and always asking questions and communicating with, hopefully, if you have a team, that's the best way to go.
Right, yeah. So maybe could you talk about what your visions are for the future of access to different types of care?
Well, I've got a lot of ideas. I always go through them all in my head, because I would love to make a big difference. At least I'm making a difference one woman at a time. But as far as going forward, there's so many movements right now having to do with reproductive justice, having to do with Black Lives Matter, having to do with cultural competence and birth. I feel like all of those are so important, and they could be really easily, or not easily, it's going to be a long road. They could be addressed with providing women with out-of-hospital options, especially during COVID. And I really think that if we look at models of systems that work, I would love to be able to help in this area to establish something like they have down in Brooklyn or in Manhattan or in Canada, but right here in Rochester. I think it's very much needed. A midwife-owned birth center, for example, would be amazing. They've made it pretty difficult to do that through requiring a certificate of need, which costs maybe $75,000 to even get started on. So they've made it pretty difficult to jump through those hoops.
Yeah. So this is a great conversation, Brigitte. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Yeah, thank you.
And that was Catherine Rafferty with Brigitte Roddy Garrison. I will mention, when my wife and I had our child 33 years ago, we had to actually go to Massachusetts, Pittsfield, Massachusetts, to find a birthing center that we could use. And I also helped a friend of mine deliver their child on a converted school bus. So over to you, Andrea.
Well, that's an adventure. Well, okay, Liz Joy is running on the Republican and Conservative Party lines to challenge incumbent Democratic Congressman Paul Tonko. And she will represent, it's to represent the New York's 20th Congressional District. HMM correspondent Corinne Carey talked to Liz about her campaign, her qualifications, and what's important to her.
Liz, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why do you think that this district needs a leadership change at this moment?
I filed to run for this congressional seat back in April of 2019. And the reason that I did is because I'm the mother of four adult children and a future grandmother. And I was highly concerned at the trajectory that I was seeing At the federal level, with the bills that were being passed continually encroaching on our freedoms, our liberties, the high taxes we were bringing less opportunity into our district here in the Capital Region from the federal level. So I filed to run against Paul Tonko so that I can get to Washington and actually bring our Capital Region voices into Washington instead of having Washington continually represented here in the Capital Region.
Can you give me some examples of the freedoms and liberties that you think are being constrained under the current representation, under the current leadership?
Yeah, so one of the things that Paul Tonko is pushing hard on is the $93 trillion Green New Deal, which would effectively wipe out all fossil fuels. It would wipe out the oil industry, the gas industry. It would wipe out the fracking industry, which we haven't even been allowed to have in our state because of the current leadership. It would, in fact, put more taxes on us as upstate New Yorkers. We would be carrying a very heavy financial load personally. We would have to retrofit all of our homes, all of our businesses. It would effectively take 18-wheelers off of the road. That's the plan, to incorporate it with electric vehicles. It's extremely expensive. We can't afford it, and he's heavily pushing for that. He's also heavily pushing for Medicare for All, which is a socialized takeover of our healthcare system. And we have five major hospitals here in the Capital Region. We have Albany Medical Center, we have Saratoga Hospital, St. Peter's, Ellis Medicine, and St. Mary's Hospital. The thing that is keeping our hospitals afloat right now are the reimbursements by the private health insurance companies that so many of the Capital Region citizens have purchased. I mean, 40% of the Capital Region has private health insurance plans, whether it's CDPHP, Blue Shield of Northeastern New York, MVP, or the Empire Plan, if they're a state worker. And Medicare for All would wipe out all private health insurance, and it would force everybody onto a government plan, which would plummet our hospitals. And effectively, it would begin to ration care, because by default, it makes providers government workers. And then the pacemakers, the defibrillators, the hip replacements, knee replacements, you know, all of those things that are afforded right now to people that are senior citizens, they're going to be the hardest hit by this. Because of the rationed care, the government is going to have to dictate who gets what and when. And I don't support that. I believe in choice.
Liz, I hope you don't mind. I just want to challenge you. Under our current system, yeah, I think it's, you know, it is scary to think about rationing care, but right now our care, and I have private health insurance, and the people making decisions about what's covered under my care are shareholders. You know, they're private companies that are operated by people who are looking to make a profit. And so my health care is being rationed all the time, but it's not by the government, it's by private insurers who want to make a profit.
So are you saying that what you qualify for and what you don't qualify for in that, are you saying that you don't have a choice in what you get to have done?
Yeah, no, sure, I have a choice in the insurance company, but every day insurance companies are making decisions about what to cover and what not to cover. So it's, in some ways, you know, I think about it as either private shareholders are making decisions about what they'll cover and what they'll pay for and what they won't, or the government is, but somebody's making that determination.
You know, that's an important point, because that's one of the reasons why I'm standing strong to bring in competition and bring it across the state, to bring more competition into our state so that there are many different plans to be able to choose from based on what your specific age is, your specific situation, your specific family life. And so that's one of the things that I'm fighting for and standing up for, as well as people being able to have the choice if they would like to bring their elderly parents back onto their plans. and keep adult children on their plan longer should they choose to, you know, for people who are in school. I know right now in the Obamacare mandate, you know, they have to get off at the age of 26. I actually don't think that that's a good idea. I think people should have the option to pool their family plans to make them larger and have much more choice in what they're purchasing. And it's got to be much more cost effective. One of the ways that we can do that is by bringing in the competition, driving down the cost of pharmaceuticals, which actually is happening. We are bringing that cost down. We need to continue to do it more. And one of the ways that we can do that is by bringing that manufacturing out of China and bringing our pharmaceuticals back here to the United States.
What past experiences or training do you have that make you uniquely qualified to represent this district?
You know, it's funny, I get that question all of the time. And as a matter of fact, the Times Union and the Schenectady Gazette said that I was not qualified to run for Congress. And I actually take their words as a compliment because I've never been a career politician like my opponent who's been there for 43 years and never actually had to run a business. He's never raised a family. He's never had to live, you know, paycheck to paycheck. He's never served his country in the military as we have. I'm a veteran's wife. I'm a Blue Star mother with a son that's currently active duty fighting for our freedoms. He's not combat, but he's standing up for our country. We've run a business and we're currently running a business. I'm an author. I'm a real estate agent and I've been a volunteer in our school and I've raised four children. So I have a lot of experience with everyday life. I know how to balance a budget. I know what it's like to live here, to work here, to try to make a paycheck, keep a business going, and watch my husband try to keep employees and not have to furlough them during a pandemic, all of which my opponent, Paul Tonko, has never had to do and actually never even took a pay cut or offered to take a pay cut during the pandemic while we saw our businesses shut down. We saw people in food lines here in New York, and he basically pulled a Biden and hid in his basement. I believe I'm uniquely qualified because I'm not a career politician. I'm a common sense mother of four, veteran's wife who wants to see my country do well, who wants to see my state do well, who wants to see families bring home more money, have better choices in our healthcare, be able to run our businesses without government infringement, stand up for our religious liberties. So, because right now we're watching governors across the country step in and shut down synagogues. We're watching them shut down houses of worship. And I'm going to stand up for our Constitution. They've raised our taxes. The Capital Region looks worse than it ever has. Gun violence has gone up. Shootings have gone up. He's been silent on bail reform, completely silent on bail reform. He's calling for the defunding of our police departments. And I will stand up for all of those things. We need to have safety and security back on our streets. We need to stand up for our law enforcement communities and thank our men and women in blue who keep us safe and secure. And I'm going to make sure all of these things happen.
Can I go back to the religious freedom argument that you made a few moments ago? Do you believe that there are public health measures that the government should take to protect vulnerable New Yorkers who seek to gather in large groups? Is there any measure that the government can take to put a limit on large gatherings in a religious context?
Well, maybe the first thing that the government should have done is limited the looting and the rioting and the marches that were happening.
Let's keep our attention.
No, let's talk about that, because what you have is a double standard, and it's not clear.
And we can address that, but I am actually curious about your viewpoint about congregating for religious reasons in large groups. Do you think that the government can do anything to address those large gatherings?
I believe the government needs to stay out of the religious liberties that are afforded to us in the First Amendment of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When you're not running for public office, what do you enjoy doing?
I was a licensed realtor before that, and so I was in the real estate business. I had been an author and had helped other people on their campaigns.
You were an author. What did you write?
I wrote a book on How to Be Salt and Light, The Christian's Guide to Voting, specifically geared to the Christian community, helping them to get involved in the voting process across the country. And you may well remember that in 2016, we had the largest evangelical turnout in history for the presidential race.
Got it. So interesting. Well, thank you so much for sharing your views on this race and your candidacy with me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it as well.
And so that was Corinne Carey interviewing Liz Joy, the Republican Conservative Party candidate in the 20th District with, I guess, Paul Tonko is the incumbent. We have on the MediaCentury.org podcast site a little bit longer interview with Ms. Joy, as well as all our other interviews for the political candidates for this November's election. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm Andrea Cunliffe. Our engineer this evening was Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. Email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Well, until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.